Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 304, titled Illegal Procedure, Organized Crime in the National Football League. We've been accessing a book in side one that will also be the provide the material for side two. That book is called Interference, subtitled How Organized Crime Influences Professional Football. This remarkable book was authored by Dan E. Moldea. M-O-L-D-E-A is his last name. The book was published in hardcover by William Morrow & Company, copyright New York, in New York, copyright 1989, by Morrow Books, or by William Morrow & Company. The ISBN number is 0-688-08303-X. This program, number 304, by the way, being recorded on May 16th of the year 2001, could be considered part two, along with program number 301, titled Mickey Mauschwitz, The Reactionary Politics of Walt Disney. These two programs are really about the politics of illusion. Walt Disney, of course, is sort of a very friendly, family-oriented, touchy-feely cultural figure, and yet the reality of Walt Disney's politics was very different indeed. And the National Football League is very much a part of Americana, and again, as a wholesome, all-American image, and yet the reality behind professional football, which I personally very much enjoy, is very, very different. I would say if you like football, and I do enjoy it, just don't bet on it, and I don't, because the reality is very, very different than the stirring surface which is presented to the American public. And the program in particular, this program is focused on links between a number of key NFL owners and the milieu of organized crime, and in turn many of these NFL/organized crime overlaps also intersect the world of power politics, the world of Richard Nixon, the world of Watergate, and also some of the organized crime connections to the assassination of President Kennedy. And we're going to revisit some of these connections in this broadcast as well. In side one, we took a look at Clint Murchison, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. We took a look at his connections to the milieu of organized crime and also to Richard Nixon. He was very close to Richard Nixon. We took a look at Carlos Marcello, one of the organized crime figures who appears to have been involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. Also, we took a look at Hugh Culverhouse, who was the attorney for B.B. Rebozo, Nixon's close friend and real estate partner. We also took a look at the fact that Hugh Culverhouse, the owner of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and his son, rather, Hugh Culverhouse Jr., was the attorney along with, was part of the legal team along with former NFL security chief Bill Hundley for Attorney General John Mitchell in Watergate. We took a look at the fact that Hugh Culverhouse was involved with a company called Major Realty, which in turn came under investigation by federal authorities because many of the people who were investors in or participants in Major Realty were people with strong associations to the milieu of Meyer Lansky, the banker of organized crime. We took a look at the fact that Plato Cacheres was a partner with Bill Hundley, and he in turn represented at one point the Hundley-Cacheres team, represented I. Irving Davidson, also very closely connected to the Dallas Cowboys and Clint Murchison. And in turn, I noted that Plato Cacheres had been Monica Lewinsky's attorney in the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton. Clinton's own attorney, Charles Ruff, will crop up in connection with the discussion that we're about to look at. Now, bearing in mind the Hugh Culverhouse connections to Major Realty and, in turn, the many evidentiary tributaries running between Major Realty and the Lansky Syndicate, listen to who bought Major Realty after Hugh Culverhouse bowed out. The announced buyer of Major Realty's land in 1968 was Edward J. DeBartolo Sr., a major builder of shopping malls around the United States, who was alleged by a variety of law enforcement agencies to have business ties with top organized crime figures including Meyer Lansky, Carlos Marcello, and Santos Trafficante. In 1970, DeBartolo's name had appeared on the U.S. Justice Department's Organized Crime Principal Subjects list, a catalog of people who are suspected of having ties to organized crime. Later, DeBartolo challenged the listing of his name on the register through his attorney, Charles F.C. Ruff. That's R-U-F-F. At the time of the action, DeBartolo was attempting to obtain a license to operate a racetrack in Oklahoma and didn't want the list to prejudice the Oklahoma Horse Racing Commission, which issues the licenses. And, by the way, later his name was removed from that list, and the validity of the list was disclaimed. Skipping down, we're going to talk about Edward DeBartolo Sr. and his purchasing of 90% of the stock in the San Francisco 49ers, and basically the fact that his son Eddie Jr. Then got the team from him. And we're also going to take a look at who the tax attorney was for the DeBartolo's purchase of the San Francisco 49ers. That tax attorney was Hugh Culverhouse, the prior owner of Major Realty, and also the attorney for B.B. Rebozo. Skipping down, we read, in March of 1977, the elder DeBartolo purchased 90% of the stock of the San Francisco 49ers for $17.6 million and made it a subsidiary of his corporation. The team was then given to his 30-year-old son. Eddie Jr. bought it from me, unquote, DeBartolo told the Pittsburgh Press. Everyone thinks I gave it to him, but Eddie financed it and paid for it, unquote. However, the senior DeBartolo personally secured his son's purchase. Tampa Bay owner Hugh Culverhouse was retained as the DeBartolo's tax attorney for the 49ers' sale. At that time, NFL Security reportedly could find nothing in the DeBartolo's background to prevent them from buying the team. However, when I asked NFL Security Chief Jack Danahy about that report, as well as the nature of the senior DeBartolo's background, Danahy replied, quote, I'm not going to discuss that one, unquote. It was the only time during my interviews with Danahy that he refused to answer a question. And, by the way, notice who else was deposed as playing a role in the DeBartolo's purchase of the 49ers. And, again, there have been many reports linking the DeBartolo's to organized crime. However, nothing has ever been proved. And, indeed, the DeBartolo's are very, very powerful people. I would know that Eddie DeBartolo's investigation in connection with gambling, which resulted in a fine, mandated his switching of the 49ers to the ownership of his sister. In addition, to the fact that the Tampa Bay Bucks owner Hugh Culverhouse was the tax attorney for the DeBartolo's sale purchase of the 49ers, take note of the fact that Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, was also involved in the sale of the 49ers to DeBartolo. And we're going to take a look at Al Davis's connections to the milieu of organized crime later on in this broadcast. Turning once again to interference, Oakland Raiders owner Al Davis stated in a sworn deposition that he, too, was directly involved in the sale of the 49ers to DeBartolo. The selling group, I guess, was the San Francisco 49ers, consisting of the two Morabito women and Lou Spadia and Frank Miuli, who would stay on with his, I think he had 10%. By the way, Franklin Miuli was also the owner of the Golden State Warriors, the basketball team, and NBA franchise. Continuing. The DeBartolo family would be buying 90% of the 49ers with options from Miuli if he wants to sell or if he wants to buy another 5%. I think they gave him a right based on his preemptive right not to let them buy, unquote. And you also represented the buying group, and that was the DeBartolo's, unquote, asked the attorney questioning Davis. Again, quoting Davis, I represented the buying group to the DeBartolo's. I didn't represent the 49ers group. I kind of brought them all together and kind of advised both of them what I thought was fair and etc. like that, yes, unquote. In return for his role as intermediary, Davis reportedly received a finder's fee of $100,000 paid by the DeBartolo's. However, Davis has been coy about the figure, indicating it was probably much higher. Soon after the DeBartolo's bought the 49ers, an FBI wiretap picked up Los Angeles mobster Jimmy Fratiano discussing a meeting with New Mexico criminal lawyer William Marchando, M-A-R-C-H-I-O-N-D-O, to be held in San Francisco. The transcript of the conversation stated, quote, Fratiano, hey, don't forget now, when the Miami Dolphins play, you're going to come over here. See, I got it arranged so you're going to sit with this guy, the owner of the 49ers. By the way, Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano was the mob's West Coast executioner and a major organized crime figure. Starting again, Fratiano, hey, don't forget now, when the Miami Dolphins play, you're going to come over here. See, I got it arranged so you're going to sit with this guy, the owner of the 49ers, Marchando. Well, I want to talk with this guy, but that's a bad time for me to leave, unquote. Fratiano explained the conversation to my associate, William Scott Malone, quote, I arranged through this friend of mine, Youngstown Mafia figure Ronald Carabia, for an attorney in New Mexico to sit with DiBartolo in the press box. They wanted to talk some kind of business. I don't know what it was, so I arranged a meeting, unquote. Fratiano added that DiBartolo Sr. was very friendly, unquote, with Carabia. He also said that the two men, quote, used to go on junkets to the Tropicana in Las Vegas, and DiBartolo was a pretty heavy gambler. He would lose a lot of money. He had a pretty good line of credit in Las Vegas, unquote. Ronald J. Parr, a racetrack owner and a respected government informant who once wore a wire during an investigation of DiBartolo, told Malone that he had come to know the shopping mall king well. DiBartolo is a heavy, heavy gambler, unquote, Parr alleges. I mean, he bets in the hundreds of thousands of dollars on the outcome of a football game. When you have a guy like that owning a football team, it makes you very nervous, unquote. The DiBartolo racetrack ownership issue also posed a striking difference of the required standards demanded by officials of the NFL and Major League Baseball. By the way, Eddie DiBartolo Sr. had been turned down by Major League Baseball for his alleged organized crime connections. Jack Danahy told me that racetrack ownership by NFL owners, quote, didn't bother me. That was a legitimate enterprise. There's no prohibition against owning a racetrack. Consequently, while DiBartolo was being turned away by professional baseball for his racetrack ties, he was embraced by the NFL. And let me stress that nothing has ever been proved about the apparent connections of the DiBartolo family to organized crime, but that in and of itself doesn't necessarily prove anything, because organized crime is very powerful and has a way of seeing to it that people don't talk. Still later, Dan Mulday talks about the USFL, the United States Football League, that arose in the early 1980s, and the fact that Eddie DiBartolo Sr. was the owner of the Pittsburgh Maulers franchise in that new league, while Eddie Jr. was the owner of the 49ers, an apparent conflict of interest. Also, Dan Mulday relates a U.S. Customs Service report by one of its special agents, William F. Berta, that alleges that the DiBartolo organization was strongly connected to organized crime in Florida, and indeed that the DiBartolo organization appears to have succeeded of Meyer Lansky as the financial wizard of organized crime. Later on, DiBartolo challenged that through his attorney, Mr. Ruff, Charles C. Ruff, and nothing again was ever proved, and Charles Ruff strongly denies the allegations. Returning once again to interference, to further complicate the NFL's problems, a new rival league was founded on May 11, 1982. Unlike the defunct World Football League, the new United States Football League immediately received a 2-year, $18 million contract with ABC TV. Also, in the first college draft in 1983, the USFL's New Jersey Generals, which were later bought by Manhattan real estate tycoon Donald Trump, signed 1982 Heisman Trophy winner Herschel Walker of Georgia. The owner of the Pittsburgh Maulers in the new league was Edward J. DiBartolo Sr., who was frequently under suspicion of having mob ties. For example, the U.S. Customs Service had received information from one of its special agents, William F. Berta, B-U-R-D-A, in January of 1981, that the DiBartolo organization, quote, through its control of particular state banks in the state of Florida, is operating money laundering schemes, realizing huge profits from narcotics, guns, skimming operations, and other organized crime-related activities. This organization is reported to have ties to Carlos Marcello, Santos Traficante, and Meyer Lansky, and because of its enormous wealth and power, has high-ranking political influence and affiliations, unquote. In an earlier report, authored by Berta, the special agent wrote that he had developed source information indicating that, quote, Meyer Lansky, the financial wizard of OC, organized crime, is now considered by most to be almost senile and getting out of the business. His successor and new financial wizard is recognized as Edward J. DiBartolo, unquote. The DiBartolo organization was extremely concerned by the allegations made by Special Agent Berta after his reports began to surface in connection with DiBartolo's bid to be licensed in Oklahoma. DiBartolo's attorney, Charles Ruff, was asked to provide a legal opinion about the Berta report. By the way, Ruff dissed the Berta report, and later on, skipping down, Dan Moldea notes, DiBartolo denied any wrongdoing and has not been charged with any. Still later, there's discussion of the response on the part of Eddie DiBartolo Jr. about a possible conflict of interest with his father owning the Pittsburgh Maulers and he owning the 49ers. There's also another allegation of connections between DiBartolo and Carlos Marcello, the former capo mafioso of New Orleans. The information also alleged that DiBartolo and Carlos Marcello worked behind the scenes to defeat a paramutual betting bill in Texas, which would have competed with the Louisiana Track. That's Louisiana Downs. The investigation of DiBartolo, who denied any wrongdoing, was later dropped. The Texas state legislature defeated the paramutual bill 75-73, just as DiBartolo had hoped. The problems of DiBartolo Sr.'s owning a team in the USFL, in direct competition with the popular Rooney family and their Pittsburgh Steelers, and DiBartolo Jr.'s owning the San Francisco 49ers in the NFL, were glaringly obvious, especially since both teams were subsidiaries of DiBartolo's parent company. Consequently, DiBartolo Jr. was confronted with the problem in March of 1983 at the NFL owners' meeting. However, both DiBartolos brushed the whole issue off. They owned their teams, they were their properties, and no one could do anything about it. "The league can't hurt me," DiBartolo Jr. said. "It's not big enough. They don't like it? That's the way it is. Nobody's going to take this team away from me, including the league, because I tell you, the league can't afford the lawsuit. I can. Enough of this bull s-blank-blank-blank about conflict of interest. That's ridiculous. They can't afford a lawsuit because I'll bury them," unquote. Now, note again that the tax attorney for the sale of the 49ers to the DiBartolos was Hugh Culverhouse, the owner of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the attorney for B.B. Rebozo. He also had been the prior owner of Major Realty, which was then bought by Eddie DiBartolo Sr., and that there are a number of figures in Major Realty who also have strong connections to the milieu of Meyer Lansky as well. And the Berta Report alleges that Eddie DiBartolo and his organization were the successors to Meyer Lansky, that's Eddie Sr., to Meyer Lansky as the financial wizard and banker for organized crime. And again, nothing has ever been proved about DiBartolo and the allegations of organized crime. And I would also note that another person heavily involved in the sale of the 49ers to the DiBartolos was Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, formerly the Los Angeles Raiders, and formerly before that, the Oakland Raiders. Al Davis as well has many connections to the milieu of organized crime and gambling. One of those was a fellow named Alan Glick, who had very strong connections to the Las Vegas gambling milieu and organized crime. Alan Glick and Al Davis were partners in the Eastmont Mall in the East Bay. And I would note that someone who was a $100,000 a year consultant to the Glick Davis Eastmont Mall since March of 1975, a woman named Tamara Rand, was murdered under strained circumstances. We're going to take a look now at the Glick Davis partnership and also Alan Glick's connections to the milieu of organized crime. Dan Moldea writes as follows. While the National Commission to Review National Policy Toward Gambling was busy advocating legalized sports gambling and insisting the mafia was no longer a factor in Las Vegas, Alan Glick, the Stardust, and Argent were in trouble with their gambling operations. Glick had to fire Lefty Rosenthal for making personnel decisions without his approval. Upon hearing the news, Rosenthal angrily told Glick, quote, "I think it's about time we had a discussion, Glick. You're not my boss. And when I say you're not my boss, I'm talking not just from an administrative position, but about your health. If you interfere with what's going on here, you will never leave this corporation alive, unquote. Glick then called Ballesteri, who confirmed Rosenthal's claims and threats. A federal prosecutor explained, quote, Nick Civella and Frank Ballesteri quarreled over Alan Glick. His failure to pay the $1.2 million obligation for getting the Teamsters loan, the hidden costs of doing business with the mob, of which naive Alan Glick was not even aware. What a trap this man was in. In March of 1975, Glick was instructed by Rosenthal to go to Kansas City, where he would meet with Nick Civella, the ailing boss of the local mafia. Glick, who was picked up at the airport by mobster Carl DeLuna, was taken to a hotel room and seated in a chair directly across from Civella, who was wearing dark clothes and dark glasses. A single bright light shone down on Glick's bald head as the men talked. Glick later described the scene as being like interrogating a prisoner in a police room, unquote. Civella coldly instructed Glick to, quote, cling to every word I say, unquote. Civella growled, quote, You don't know me, but if it would be my choice, you wouldn't leave this room alive, unquote. With Glick's full attention, Civella demanded that Glick give him $1.2 million. He explained that he, not Frank Ballesteri, had been responsible for getting Glick his loans from the Teamsters pension fund, and that he, Civella, was among Glick's secret partners. Glick said that Ballesteri had not explained that to him. When Glick replied that he didn't have any untraceable cash for the payoff, Civella told Glick that Rosenthal would take care of it. You have a commitment to us, Civella said. You owe us $1.2 million. I want that paid. In addition, we own part of your corporation, and you are going to do nothing to interfere with it. We will let Mr. Rosenthal continue with the casinos, and you are not to interfere, unquote. According to Glick, when he returned to Las Vegas from Kansas City, he complained to Rosenthal that he had been misled. Rosenthal then informed him, quote, You are no longer in a position where you control your destiny in this company, unquote. That sounded ominous, but Glick's problems were just beginning, and they would implicate Al Davis. Tamara Rand had been a $100,000-a-year consultant to the Glick-Davis Eastmont Mall since March of 1975, the same month as Glick's meeting with Civella. A San Diego businesswoman and a partner with Glick in several real estate projects, Rand received the consultant's fee as a means of paying off a portion of a $500,000 loan Rand had earlier made to Glick when he purchased Recreon. After Saratoga went sour in 1975, Rand filed a $560,000 lawsuit against Glick, charging that he had defrauded her in a San Bernardino, California land deal. On November 9, 1975, the 54-year-old Mrs. Rand was found shot to death in the kitchen of her Mission Hills house. Her body had been hit with 5 bullets fired from a high-standard .22-caliber semi-automatic pistol with a well-tooled silencer. Holes had been drilled through the barrel of the gun to dissipate sound, and the steel wool-packed silencer sleeve fit over the barrel to further muzzle the shots. One bullet was found in her back, one entered her brain through her left ear, and 3 were clearly visible under her chin. All 5 had been fired at close range. She had been killed between 3 p.m. and 5:30 p.m. There were no indications of a forced entry, and nothing of value had been stolen. Her body was found by her husband, Dr. Philip Rand, a prominent San Diego obstetrician. A homicide officer with the San Diego Police Department told me that when he saw Rand's body, he also saw a message delivered. The configuration of the wounds made us believe that the murder was a warning as well as an indication of why Mrs. Rand was killed. To me, when somebody gets shot like that, it means that they have been talking too much and were being silenced. According to our information, she was going to expose someone's activities, unquote. On advice of counsel, Glick refused to respond to oral questions about the murder from the San Diego police. Instead, he asked that all questions be submitted in writing through his attorney. His refusal to cooperate raised suspicions and placed him at center stage in the investigation. Underworld figure Jimmy Fratiano told my associate, William Scott Malone, quote, Well, Frank Bonpensiero, the one-time head of the San Diego Mafia, told me that Spilotro, that's Tony the Ant Spilotro, killed Tamara Rand. And Tamara Rand had a lot to do with Glick. I don't know if she was his secretary or whatever it was, but she was very close to him and had a lot of information. And they, the underworld, found out that she was going to tell the FBI or whatever. And they just killed her. They didn't want Glick to get in no trouble. That would mean they would lose the Stardust. After the Rand murder, he'd started coming down on Glick's partner, Al Davis. When challenged about his view that the NFL rule forbidding associations with gamblers, particularly his business relationship with Glick, Al Davis answered in a deposition, quote, "Sometimes there is association with gambling, and sometimes there is the appearance of being associated with gamblers, and I think direct association is wrong," unquote. When asked to explain what he meant, Davis responded, "It is what it is. You know, when I came into the National Football League, many of our owners owned horses, owned dog tracks, owned all the familiar gambling habitats of gamblers and gambling. We have learned to accept this in the National Football League. We have people, as I say, who own hotels in Las Vegas, and it is not frowned upon. We have learned to accept in our business a differentiation between association and appearance." That is the point I was trying to get across. Roselle, unquote, by the way. Roselle, that's NFL Commissioner Pete Roselle, had become increasingly critical of Davis and advised him to divorce himself from his business ties with Glick. However, Roselle did not force the issue, saying publicly that Davis's investment in the Eastmont Mall was just a tax shelter, unquote. NFL Security Chief Jack Danahy recalls, "Glick was the subject of a big FBI investigation, and he was of interest to us because he shared ownership with some of our people in the NFL. There was the shopping center deal he had with Al Davis, but our people found out a lot about Glick after they bought it. He was just coming under FBI scrutiny, and you couldn't just walk up to Al Davis and say, 'You gotta sell this thing,'" unquote. There were several other people involved, and they bailed out of it. We went to them and said that this guy, Glick, was bad news, and they severed their relationships with him. Al Davis said, "As far as I know, this guy is a lawyer, and he's my partner," unquote. Pete consulted with the league lawyers, and they said we couldn't do anything. Later on, of course, it developed that Glick was a frontman for the mob, unquote. Although NFL coaches Chuck Knox, Don Shula, and John Ralston gave up their interests with Glick businesses, Davis refused to do so. As a consequence, he was investigated by the NFL, and his tax returns were mulled over by the IRS. One of the most famous people involved with sports betting, of course, was Jimmy the Greek Snyder, who for a while hosted the NFL's pregame program on CBS. Jimmy the Greek himself had crossed with the world of organized crime early in his career. In a footnote, Dan Moldea writes, "Jimmy the Greek, with the editorial assistance of Mickey Herskowitz and Steve Perkins, Jimmy the Greek by himself, New York, Playboy Press, 1975, pages 145 and 6. Snyder, whose real name is Dimitrios Georgios Synodinos, is a 10th grade dropout from Steubenville, Ohio, and the son of a grocer in a local ma and pa store. Skipping down. Snyder pleaded no contest to interstate transportation of bets and wagering information in 1963. He was fined $10,000 and placed on probation for 5 years. He received a full and unconditional pardon from President Gerald Ford in December of 1974. In his autobiography, Snyder wrote that he had met Ford while he was still a congressman at the home of Robert Mayhew, the liaison between the CIA and the Mafia in the Castro assassination plots. In The Guns of November, Part 1, we took a look at possible connections between those plots and the assassination of President Kennedy. Of course, Gerald Ford was a key member of the Warren Commission. This concludes Side B of For the Record Program Number 304, Illegal Procedure of Organized Crime in the NFL. There will be a detailed description of this program on the in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. And sister station WFMU is compiling these broadcasts on real audio archives. There are two links to the WFMU websites in the Spitfire in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. That concludes this broadcast. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.